Let's give a nice warm welcome this morning to David Powell. David served over in Vietnam in the mid-60s and has suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. He's going to be coming to Vermont. He'll be the keynote speaker at an event that's coming up on March 3rd, which is going to be a Vermont Veterans Combat Stress Symposium. It'll be happening in Montpelier. And the idea here is to help not only those that are serving overseas right now, but also other vets, people that are in the their loved ones, people that are in the medical community, to try to help them understand this better and also find out about some of the new treatments of which David has participated as well. So without any further ado, let's give a nice home Radio Vermont welcome to David Powell, whose book, My Tour in Hell, A Marine's Battle with Combat Trauma, is a heck of a read. David, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. That was a nice introduction.
Well, I have to tell you, your book was really just... What really struck me, David, is that you got on the ground in Vietnam, and it seems from your book that it was like within almost hours, if not days, when you were seeing sort of the initial, what I would call, really bad stuff. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. Your assessment is right. It was a matter of hours. I landed in Da Nang on my way to Chu Lai in the afternoon. By the evening of that day, Da Nang had a rocket attack at the airbase, and we hit for cover. And until I left 13 months later, it was nonstop combat. Took a little bit out of me, frankly.
Mm-hmm. One of the first things that you witnessed was one of your fellow Marines. Was it a fellow Marine who shot somebody?
Shot the squatting Viet Cong?
Yeah.
Yes.
What happened there?
Actually, in the book, it sums up the experiences of my first combat operation the size of a company. And it was after the second Marine had struck a booby trap and was screaming in agony that this fellow who was guarding one of our captured noticed that the captured Viet Cong was smiling and quietly laughing to himself at the screams of our veteran. It upset him to the point where he just decided he'd kill him, which he did.
Mm-hmm.
That shocked me, but I was close to that level of anger myself by that time.
It also was not, I mean, it was an incredibly short period of time between when you hit the ground and when you were in combat. And, you know, one of the things that really stood out is that there are a number of times here where you really felt like you had been, quote-unquote, abandoned by your fellow Marines.
Yes. Three of them specifically came to mind as I was writing my memoir. May or may not have been more times, but at least that many. It's not like in the movies, and my book goes on that way entirely. It's not glorified blood and guts. It's just real time.
Mm-hmm.
You can say you're going to do something, but when items hit the fan, it's everybody for himself.
Yep.
It's without animosity that I reported those items. It was more out of understanding and empathy for the way the fellows feel. I know when I got shot at and it was close enough to hear it or see it, I didn't know there was anybody else around. And I was doing anything I could to save my own life. So being abandoned is just an expression.
Mm-hmm. The story behind you enlisting with the Marines, you were not you weren't dying to go over there.
No, sir. I had quite a nice little setup for myself that looked like it was going to extend into old age. I was 24. I think the draft ended at 26, so I thought I was well out of the cusp. I was in data processing. Specifically, I was a computer programmer, and in 64, 65, 66, that was an unheard of vocation. Now it's so leading edge. It's,
yeah.
And had I been able to stay in it, I think I would have done .com pretty successfully. Came to me naturally.
Mm-hmm.
I was married some 2 years, had a home, two good cars, and was planning on having children, living my life in Southern California till I got that postcard that said, we'd like to see if you're physically fit. Then the whole world changed.
Mm-hmm. You were in Vietnam 13 months?
13 months, 397 days.
Can you give our listeners and me a sense of what the day-to-day survival is like? Because I think a lot of people just don't appreciate how incredible it is.
Thank you. I'd be happy to. My military specialty was rockets and flamethrowers. And essentially what that meant to me was that I went on two or three times as many patrols as the basic infantry rifleman. And that's because there were fewer of us to supplement a fire team of mere riflemen. We had to have machine gunners and rocket men with almost every squad that went out. The day would start at sometime before dawn. I say that because we used to stand watch every night. Watch meant going outside of the tent, sitting on a bunker, and looking out for incoming Viet Cong that might want to catch us while we're sleeping. And we'd stay out from 2 to 4 hours at a time. The longest watch was the last. Usually started about 4 in the morning and then didn't end because the sun came up. What would then typically happen was I'd fix myself something to eat from a box of sea rations rather than go to the mess hall, wait for a squad to get ready to go out, find out who the squad leader was, get in touch with the machine gunner, join up with the squad and walk out into the countryside looking for booby traps, Viet Cong, and heaven forbid we'd find regular North Vietnamese army people, which meant we were stumbling upon a major attack. That, frankly, never happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
Stay out on a patrol, taking two or three breaks at a time, maybe grab another bite to eat from sea rations, and then come back through the wire to the hill that we called home after about 5 to 6 hours of walking. Then maybe do that again a second time that day, or luck have it, sit down and clean the weapons and wait for bunker watch again.
The time just sort of, was it suspended? I mean, did you have, how was time moving in this 397 days?
Time moved for me a day at a time. I didn't start counting how many days I had left until I had just over 30 days left. The reason I didn't was because every day, every next day, I should say, I felt was probably going to be my last day. I was sure I was going to die over there, frankly. So measuring the future was futile. Getting through the day was the most important thing on my mind. Not a powerful way to live, but
mm-hmm.
it kept my attention on the here and now,
mm-hmm.
which is part of what I consider to be post-traumatic stress, and that is a state of hypervigilance and ever-awareness. Also, exaggerated startle response. Any odd noise is danger. It's a warning of danger.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping yourself alive spends a lot of your energy, and
yep.
There's not much time to read the horoscope, look to the future. That's how I spent my time.
And it's not like you were on a base or anything. I mean, you were out in the jungle the whole time, pretty much.
Out in the jungle. We had tents. The tents had no floors. Ergo mud or dry earth. When we did get shipments that came on pallets, we would scavenge for the pallets to make ourselves floors. We had cots, blankets, usually one each. Most of the time slept in our fatigues, our shirt and pants, boots off, rifle at the ready, usually propped up against the cot, and tried to catch our 4 hours of sleep a night, but it was not wood-sided, tin-roofed doors and windows, casual buddy-slapping strolls to the mess hall and have a breakfast, lunch, or dinner. It's not civilian.
Talking with David Powell, he served as a Marine in Vietnam, 66 to 67. He's written My Tour in Hell. Did I get the date right on that?
66 through 67 was my 13 months in Vietnam.
Okay. His book is called My Tour in Hell, A Marine's Battle with Combat Trauma. Did you have any sense, David, in the time, in the present then, that you were being affected?
I didn't know that I was being traumatized. I did know that I was doing my utmost best to save my life, and second, to save as many guys around me as I could. That was my entire focus. I was going to be the best survivor that I could possibly be, and I wanted my gravestone to read that. He did his best to be with us. I thought of nothing else. I was a machine. I didn't weep, though I felt great remorse and great sorrow sometimes. It's pretty much a cocoon, an emotional cocoon you crawl into, and you stay there until you're frankly damn certain you're not going to have to go back. And that didn't come to me until November 10th in 1967, when I landed in Southern California and got off that plane.
Mm-hmm. What was the worst part?
The worst part was returning from rest and recuperation that I took on Oahu in Hawaii to see my wife and supposedly get some rest. When I got back on that plane, headed for Vietnam, I knew I was headed for my certain demise. With the 7 months that I had known, I was poor choice of word, dead positive I wasn't going to make it. So it was a very solemn ride home, Nam.
It was a terrible trip too that you had with your wife.
Yes, it was. I was a combat Marine instead of her husband, and the poor thing. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. Should have. But when you're desperate for love, you forget everything, and you do. I did stupid things. I should have never exposed somebody I knew to what I knew.
Mm-hmm. What part of the 13-month experience, now in retrospect, do you think most traumatized you?
The most traumatic was when I was shot in a daylight ambush, and that was 2 months into my tour. It's an out-of-body experience like I've never known, and you'll find in that my description in the book lacks clarity, but it does describe the fact that all I was doing was waiting for Heavenly Father to come pick me up. nobody around me. That was one of my abandonment episodes. I was hit. I was bleeding. I was down on the ground. I had a rocket launcher with me, but the rocket had misfired, and no A-gunner to reload me. So it was just out there listening to the buzz of the bullets go over and waiting for the next one to hit me a little harder. That was the worst.
Mm-hmm. Boy, there was a heck of a story early on in your tour when your gun jammed and basically everybody ran away from you. What happened there?
That was a real joy.
Oh, my gosh.
That was the first time I attempted to fire a rocket. We were on either a company-sized or larger operation. It was within 2 weeks of me getting in country. The front of a column of men I was with came under pretty intense fire from about 100 meters away. The smoke from the rifles that they used partially gave away their position. The sound of the rapid fire also helped pinpoint the position. When such a thing was possible, they would call the team of rockets, which was our name, team of two, to come up. And the purpose of us getting into the line of fire and so on was to shoot a white phosphorus rocket, which was filled with a chemical that when it exploded, it would send up plumes of white smoke. The point being that we would fire a white phosphorus rocket as close to where the enemy was firing from as we could. Then a forward observer for our artillery in the rear would call in grid coordinates on the map that would pinpoint where the artillery people were supposed to shoot. That's a background to being called up that day that you refer to shoot the White Phosphorus rocket. I knelt down at the squad leader's instructions, aimed the rocket and squeezed it, and it misfired in the tube. I heard it sizzle, but it didn't go out. So did my squad leader at the time. His name was Jones. He yelled pretty much at the top of his lungs, "Hang fire," which meant that the rocket that was in the tube that was on my shoulder next to my ear had a live round in it, meaning that the rocket was ready to explode, but it wasn't going where it should have. It was staying right on my shoulder. That sent everyone within earshot running away out of their own harm's way. That left me sitting like a black cat on a white sand beach with nobody around for several minutes, which were spent 1 second at a time waiting for that thing to tear my head off. It didn't, or we wouldn't be talking today, but that was the rocket experience.
Mm. Which you then got out of by tossing a grenade down the thing. I mean, wow.
Yeah. It had to be exploded because it was going to go off if it ever slipped out of the tube. So detonated it as safe as I could and then went forward.
Talking, David Powell is the author of A Tour in Hell, A Marine's Battle with Combat Trauma. We're going to talk a little bit more about his post-traumatic stress in a minute or two here. I want to remind you, too, David will be the keynote speaker at an event that's coming up on the 3rd of March. This is a Vermont Veterans Combat Stress Symposium. Those of you that are interested or concerned about this issue, whether you're have a family member who's serving overseas, whether or not you're in the healthcare industry, We would encourage you. There's a phone number that I can give you here if you want to get more information. The event is free. It's open to the public. This will be happening from noon to 5 on March 3rd at the Capitol Plaza in downtown Montpelier. If you want to get more information, you can call Lisa at 472-6444. I'm going to put that number up on our website, too, and that's at markjohnsonshow.com. And if you want to attend the event or if you want to get more information, that's how you do it. You're listening to FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. Take a quick commercial break. Back in a moment.
That too few people are finding the nerve to admit it to themselves and seek mental health. And further, too few of us are looking for signs that people are suffering in silence with post-traumatic stress. My book details the two decades of crash and burn of my personal life and of the lives of people I touched until I finally admitted that I needed professional help, mental help, to regain my self-esteem and to perform as a dignified, respectful human being in today's society. I'm not Democrat, I'm not Republican, I'm a former veteran who loves all veterans and hopes that they hear me and if they need help seek it without shame. That's my story, sir.
Did you, after you came back, as you mentioned, you had a two-decade period that was, I mean, everything from difficult relationships with people, financial trouble, alcoholism. Were you able to sort of step outside yourself at all? Did you know you were in trouble?
That's an excellent question. Thank you. I came back in 1967. It wasn't until 1980 that the American Psychiatric Association even said there was such a thing as post-traumatic stress. So for at least 13 years, Mark, I had nowhere to turn and didn't know I needed to turn anywhere. By that time, I had pretty much eaten up any self-esteem or coping skills that I had left when I came home.
But did other people say to you, David, you know, you're not the same guy as when you went? David, you know, your alcoholism is out of control. Were there people that were saying to you, you need help?
I was so bad that uh, the people that knew me kicked me to the curb. They said, oh, that's plenty, thank you. I'll never see you again. And they moved on and left me to my own self-destruction. No, there was no staying power around me. No one holding my hand saying, come on, wake up, get over it.
Mm-hmm.
Put the bottle down, go talk to a counselor, go talk to a priest, a rabbi, a minister. Go sit in a gospel wagon. No, there's nobody to help me do that. I'd burn them up.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the stories of how you pushed friends away are just too painful to even talk about.
Right.
You know, but there was one experience that actually I mentioned to you before we went on the air that was seems in hindsight such a clear sign of that you were in trouble. You were playing golf with some relatives shortly after you came home. What happened?
I was out. You're right. That was a very early warning sign. This was July 4th of 1968. My parents were still hanging with me. They thought, and probably most people did, that all I had to do was get over myself, reintegrate into the normal activities of civilian life. War is over for you, so put it down and get on with it. We went out. Parents invited me to a par-3 nine-hole golf course to knock some balls around, do a little chatting, and enjoy the 4th of July. I went out with them, didn't talk much. I wasn't real up on current events, and so I didn't really have much day-to-day stuff to talk with them. Got up to, I think it was the 8th hole, and had chipped onto the green. All three of us had. And when we approached the green, getting ready to putt out, I thought that I had just been ambushed. I heard what I thought was gunfire, and without further ado, I thought I was in Vietnam getting ambushed, and I thought I was going to get hit again. The next thing I knew when I came to was that I was laying in a sand trap thinking I had a rifle in my shoulder. It turned out to be my putter. And the gunfire that I thought I heard was firecrackers. The reaction my parents had and displayed was not different than what most people did whenever I acted funny. On that morning, when I came to, if you will, I looked at my mom and dad, and they were staring at me. But when they saw my eyes catch theirs, they both, without a word, turned around and looked 180 degrees opposite, as though they never saw me act foolish. That is representative, I think, of the reaction I had in other times and other re-stimulations in those early years that pretty much burned up any relationships that formerly were mine.
And, you know, your response to that was an interesting sort of coping mechanism, too.
Yeah, it was a way to kind of put it to bed and make light of it. I brushed the sand off, looked at myself kind of stupid, staring at my shoes, and said, "Well, happy 4th of July." It wasn't funny, but I tried to make it so.
Mm. David Powell is our guest. His book is My Tour in Hell. He'll be here in Vermont in early March to be the keynote speaker at a symposium on combat stress. You can join us right now at 244-1777, toll free 1-877-291-8255, and Chittenden County at 434-4142, and you can also find them online at jamesoninsurance.com. When we come back, we're going to find out why it is that what happened that prompted David to go and get some help, and about this really novel therapy that he went through called traumatic incident reduction. We'll find out all about that in a moment. So, David, 1989, you finally got some help. What was going on then, and what did you? How far did you have to hit rock bottom here, I guess?
Well, thank you. I hit rock bottom. To answer your question quickly and then with a little bit of length, I asked a psychotherapist that about 1993. I was using ongoing therapy to maintain some of the wounds I had recently had. I said, what the heck happened to me in 1988 when up till then I was doing okay? And she said, well, frankly, David, you just burned yourself out. And I said, man, that was the one that made the most sense to me. I'd exhausted every other ounce of courage and strength that I had left. What happened was I was going along, heading toward bankruptcy, and working at one of many short-order jobs I had, trying to sell data processing services, living with a girl some 15 years my junior, who, out of the blue, came home and told me that she was moving out, moving in with a guy that was 10 years younger than I, and sayonara. That broke my heart and my spirit. That got me to call the Veterans Administration and see if I couldn't get some professional help. I tried working with the Veterans Administration at the Mental Health and Rehabilitation Center in Menlo Park, California, which in those years was the mecca for PTSD. Actually, I had only heard of PTSD when I went to the VA. No one came and told me about it. Some 16 months of once-a-week group therapy did me no good, and I quit after having almost killed myself. Then, by mere chance, I met a fellow who was one of the founding quote-unquote fathers of a therapy to reduce the stress of traumatic experiences. It was and is called traumatic incident reduction, pretty simple, and it has a nonprofit association with it. His name was Gerald French. Traumatic incident reduction, or abbreviated as TIR, is a one-on-one, closed door, no drugs, no hypnosis, no distraction, no re-stimulation. One episode or trauma at a time until it's done. Talk with an expert listener over and over again about the same thing until it becomes clear. And by that, Mark, I mean to say that in my experience and in others, I submit, when a person undergoes a traumatic experience, some of it gets recorded in recall areas of the brain. Other portions of it get recorded in, like, the preconscious or the subconscious areas. The end result is that the traumatic experience is cloudy at best, horrible and re-stimulating, but not clear. And being not fully understood and clear, there's no place to file the memory in some ordinary place in the mind. So it just kind of tosses around in the breeze every now and then. A loud noise will remind you of a gunfire experience, as an example. But all it does is put you back in that place. It isn't a regular memory. What happened for me, and I submit for others, after I did some traumatic incident work, I could say, when I heard a loud noise, I could say to myself, I wonder where that's coming from and what that noise was. Instead of what I used to do was dive, like I did on the golf course, in fear and self-survival, and physically and mentally be back in Vietnam. I could stay in the here and now, and the relief and the strength that gave me was in part why I wrote the book.
How was talking about the incidents that you saw that created trauma for you? I guess I'm just not understanding how this therapy works. Why is talking about it and talking about it and talking about it make a difference when you hear a noise?
A noise, for instance. Talking about it over and over again brings to the surface of the patient's mind some of the details that are previously obscured. If, for instance, the loud noise, if I've talked about being ambushed and I heard the noise, I didn't remember that it only lasted maybe 30 seconds. It seemed like an eternity. And I didn't remember that the squad leader turned around and came back into the tree line and returned fire and stopped the ambush from continuing. I didn't have that experience of relief and salvation, the gaining of safety at the hands of someone who was trying to help me. All I had was the abandonment and the fear associated with it. But talking it through, all of the other aspects of that event became clear and recallable. And I found that when it was clear and recallable, it lost its charge. It lost its energy and ability to cripple me in place. It was, oh yeah, that happened. But then this, which was good, happened, and this is how it came out, and I'm here today, if that helped you at all. Mm,
yeah, it did.
Good.
Have you been able, I know you're not a shrink, but have you been able to get any sense about why our brains, when you're in a safe situation like back here at home, you're on a golf course, you hear a noise, why it is that you get thrown back into the situation before? I mean, if you were in a jungle, I guess I could understand it happening, but it's confusing to me.
Okay. Do my best, Mark. If a traumatic experience like I described is incomplete, then it's kind of like, in my words, you're forced to repeat it until you understand it. And if you don't take the time to microscopically look at the event that traumatized you, then you're never going to fully understand it. And therefore, you're doomed to repeat it, no matter the setting, no matter the time. If there is a stimulus that brings you back, you're right there. It's not recall. It's being there.
But there must be some sort of a defense element to this. There must be some reason that, you know, our primitive brain does this as some sort of a safety, a defensive thing. But I guess I don't understand why it would be happening, you know, in places that most of us would consider to be pretty non-threatening.
I guess for me, it's because, like when you and I first started chatting, combat or life-threatening situations are just that, and there is no appropriate reaction other than self-survival when you get scared. The only thing to do is try and save your life. If that's to jump into a hole, run into a tree line, get out of bright lights and get into a closet, whatever you tell yourself you need to do is what you'll do at that survival moment, until you realize that you are finally safe and you realize that the stimulations that surrounded the trauma are in the past and they belong with the trauma, not the here and now, you're going to keep doing it. I did, anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you're on the air with David Powell.
Hello, David.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Mark. You've done an excellent job of describing it. I'm not a psychologist, but I've worked at the instruction of psychologists for 12 years with both adults and children that have suffered. They've been traumatized in one way or another.
Uh-huh.
And your explanations are wonderful. I've got another one for you guys that one psychologist gave me. The part of the brain that's doing this is, Mark, you said primitive, which was perfect. It's from our early development when we were, at far more risk of being eaten by different critters out there in the environment, So it's part of the fight, flight, or response or part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's actually trying to do is defend you. It's trying to get you to react, to save your life, which I think David said as well. And the problem with that is that, we're in a different type of society now, and not every, crack of a branch means that there's, a saber-toothed tiger around the corner. Now, dealing with it or describing it, a psychologist told me, think of it like a series of snapshots or a slideshow, and they never change. They're always the same. And if you don't have a context to put them in, they're exactly what they were. They're that photograph at that time, and that's why you go right back to it. That's why you dive to the ground on a golf course, because it's like a photographic memory that this you're at that event. So you have to have a context to say, wait a minute, I'm on a golf course, I'm no longer in Vietnam. Snapping of a branch doesn't mean that there's, a Viet Cong, hiding in the brush.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to talk that through, because that part of your brain is very powerful, because it's meant to save your life.
That was excellent,
yeah.
Bob.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so.
Anything you want to add to that, David?
No, I thought that he said that very well, and wish I had the same skill.
I think you've done pretty well.
Hey.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 1-877-291-8255. Is there anything that we can do as a government, I guess, and when people go and serve in combat? I mean, is there any way to diminish this, either up front or when you come back, or?
Mark, yes. And,
you describe this coming back, and you've been in the jungle, and then next thing you know, you're going out to dinner with your wife, and it's too much.
Mind.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. In 1989, the federal government established in Vermont the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Its web is NCPTSD. There's a wealth of information there, which I bring up at the symposium. But essentially this, they call things for the veteran or the service member and the family. Family readiness assistance and family assistance centers and so on, whose stated mission is to do just what you said, Mark, get right up next to the kid and his loved ones and carefully walk them back into life, get them treatment if they need it, but at least make sure that they transition from military life, whether it be combat or non-combat, back into society and living as a civilian. That's their stated goal. It's written. I wish that there was an emphasis on implementation. I don't see it. Now, that's just me speaking. But I don't see it on a local level here in Arizona. I don't hear about it on a local level in any areas of Vermont, as Lisa will attest to, Lisa Silk, who put this thing together. If, in essence, if they did what they say they intend to do, yes, there is hope and healing. But since they don't, it's up to the individual and their loved ones to find it within the government or look to traumatic incident reduction. Find it outside of the government, but get the help. I think that people will get an idea, Mark, of why I wrote the book at this time by reading my preface rather than even having to endure going through the book. My call is that they reach out for help, no matter where it is. Like I mentioned, I went to the VA for over a year and a half, albeit when I went, they were still getting their hand on things in that it wasn't even fully known as a disorder, let alone how to treat it, which I submit takes some specific skills. I believe that some people in the service want to maintain the illusion that everything is fine, thank you. I'm not bothered by any of my experiences while I am in the service. And that precludes them from going, getting help.
Mm-hmm.
That was my call.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm going to take a couple of more calls here, and I appreciate you being very generous with your time, which I appreciate.
Oh, I'm happy to do so. I'm very pleased.
All right. Let's go to Middlesex. Stanley, good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Mark. Good, thank you. First of all, I mean, my admiration for this this man and his courage for going through all that he's gone through.
Thank you.
The next thing, though, is this is okay. This is the short answer. I remember talking to a psychologist once, a woman, and she gave an example of women who experienced rape, and it's like, what do you do to get over that trauma? And the short, simple answer she said was, you talk about it, you talk about it, you talk about it, versus keeping it inside and just, you know, burying it, hiding it, being ashamed of it.
Right.
So for these guys in the military, an example, actually, of the talking is the support you can get. And I remember reading somewhere about veterans returning. And in the hospital, they were fine because they were around other veterans. And then when they were discharged, they went out into the community, and they didn't have the same sort of, you know, understanding and support. And so, you know, helping each other through I mean, a formal sort of VA program or the support group kind of a thing, you know, short and simple is being able to talk about it, not being ashamed of it. Again, thank this guy and keep up the good work.
Yeah, because, David, I mean, you know, you have pointed out, or I think you did, that, I mean, this really is very applicable, this therapy that you got for just what Stanley was talking about, too.
Just exactly what Stanley was talking about. And to amplify what he was saying, that sets the Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq veterans apart from prior wars, just as an example. Coming home from the Pacific after the Japanese surrendered, it took months aboard ship from port to port and so on. And there was a lot of time to just sit and talk with your mates and go over what happened compared to my account, where it was a mere 20 hours from the streets of Da Nang to the arms of my then wife. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so, as I say in my preface, I see them coming home silently. I hear them crying, though they're not crying in public. Gosh, get help.
Mm-hmm.
And help is talking it through.
Okay, but, you know, you were so resistant to getting help.
I wasn't broken. That was my opinion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Though, I mean, gosh, yeah. the signs were certainly there, my friend.
I know it. I know it, Mark.
But so what if you had, let's say you were married to somebody that was coming back that was clearly having signs of this but was being resistant. How on earth do you move somebody into that direction?
I talk about it briefly and not enough in the book, but basically you get them home, you get them safe, you get them fed, you get them rested, you get them sober, you get them in a safe place like man and wife, and you sit down and you say to the service person, what happened? And if you don't get an answer, or you get an answer like, you wouldn't understand, or I don't want to talk about it, then encourage them to see some trained mental health professional and have them answer that question to that trained person. And don't let go of it. Don't force mental health on someone who resists it, but always make it daily available. Don't pretend to be a therapist yourself if you're not, but do everything you can to facilitate that person getting help, mental professional help. In preparing for a talk after my book was published for some mothers of serving combatants, they invited me to talk to them about PTSD at a lunch, and part of that caused me to develop a simple oversized postcard that lists warning signs of post-traumatic stress, things to look for that are passive but observable in the veteran that you're concerned about, such as being quiet when they used to be talkative, jumpy, avoiding certain news programs because they're re-stimulating, and so on. That postcard and a few other handouts are going to be available at the symposium. Given sufficient notice, I'm sure I could get some of your other listeners, if they wanted it, one of their own, even if they can't attend the symposium.
Mm-hmm.
A way to get more information is to go to my website, which has a button that says contact author, and they can email me, and I'll do what I can.
MyTourInHell.com.
Yes, sir.
And that's, can you read that? You mentioned earlier that people should read the preface of your book. Can you do that at the website?
You can. You can read the preface, you can read the foreword, you can read an excerpt from Chapter 2. There's information about the publisher of the book. There's a wealth of stuff you can find there.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage people to do so.
Let me take one more call here. Let's go to Barry Cameron. Good morning. You're on there with David Powell.
Yeah, good morning, Mark. David, thank you very much for your service.
I'm also
a Vietnam vet. I came back in 1969 after 2 years.
Thank you.
And I still suffer from PTSD. And I've been contacted by a group that I wanted to tell you about called the IAVA, which is the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with that?
I have heard of them. I don't know of their work.
Oh, it's run by the executive director is Paul Rykoff, and he's been on TV, like on Hardball with Chris Matthews and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And It's a great organization, and while I think of it, can I give you the web address of that?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, it's www.iava.org.
Great.
Cameron, have you gone to anybody to get help or anything?
This is a beautiful place, and this is all veterans. It's nonprofit, 501c. And what they can do is any veteran or non-veteran that wants to learn about PTSD, they're traveling. They travel all over the country now, talking about the health care of veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and also all the other veterans that are not getting the help that they need. You've heard the Walter Reed debacle here recently on the news.
Right.
And, you know, they're bringing to light the problems. You know, some of these guys, when they come back, they have to wait 6 months just to see a doctor on PTSD, and then they're discouraged not to do anything about it.
As you were
speaking earlier.
Thank you for your service.
One fellow that came back, and he was going to re-sign, but he decided that after his second tour that he'd opt out, and they gave him a sheet of paper and said, and that's the thing that put a stain on his record, and he had to pay back his re-up money and everything else, and he went broke, and you know, he just didn't have anywhere to turn. But he's one of the members now of the IAVA, and he's getting the help that he needs, and you have to really push for it. They're pushing the legislation through in Congress right now to get more help, and they take donations, they're doing press releases, and it's a great site to go to and to join.
Okay. Cameron, I got to be rude, and I'm sorry, but I have to interrupt you, but I appreciate it. IAVA.org. David, any final thought, comment you want to share with us?
My thank you to yourself for being such a kind host. My thanks to all the veterans then and now. My hope is that you get help, no matter the source, but the fact that you do. And God bless America.
Well, God bless you, my friend. I appreciate your time this morning, and I think you've done just a hell of a service, so thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you have a great trip to Vermont. My only disappointment, I'm going to be out of town next week. Otherwise, I'd come and bug you personally. But
you'll be in my thoughts.
I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
David Powell is the author of My Tour in Hell. He'll be in Vermont, part of the Vermont Veterans Combat Stress Symposium. Again, the number 472-6444 for more information.